We said that you should work from home if you can and only go to work if you must. We now need to stress that anyone who can't work from home, for instance, those in construction or manufacturing, should be actively encouraged to go to work, and we want it to be safe for you to get to work. So you should avoid public transport if at all possible, because we must and will maintain social distancing and capacity will therefore be limited. So, work from home if you can, but you should go to work if you can't.
UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson changed his tone during his speech this weekend, encouraging people to stay alert instead of staying at home. The UK is not alone in trying to figure out how to do it. France is gradually opening up. Shanghai Disneyland reopened with temperature checks and masks for a limited number of visitors. The U.S. has a mixed message, with some states continuing to shelter in place, others lifting or loosening restrictions. Despite the virus infiltrating the walls of the White House, despite polls that show many Americans don't want the nation reopened until it's safe, and the experience in other countries that have tried to reopen is mixed. Outbreaks have popped up in South Korea, in Germany, and for the first time in more than a month, Wuhan, China, has reported a small new cluster. Alex Ward has been following the global impact of this pandemic. He covers international security and defense issues for Vox. Welcome back to Press Play.
Happy to be here.
Well, let's start with the UK. What's happening there? How are they opening up?
So slowly, Boris Johnson, who initially was somewhat skeptical of the effects of the coronavirus, was considering herd immunity at one point, has now decided that, you know, what the country really needs is to slowly get things back to normal. So as he's seeing the amount of cases in the UK start to drop, he's thinking, okay, some people can go back to work, people can go outside, do outdoor activity, try to keep it among your close family if you're going to play sports, but otherwise stay vigilant, stay alert, don't take unnecessary risks because they're not out of the woods. And the UK for the moment is going to consider this opening as sort of a soft launch, let's say, as it continues to see the amount of cases continue to drop, although they'll monitor this on a day-by-day basis.
And are the cases dropping there? Are they turning the tide?
Turning the tide is perhaps too strong. There are some indications that the UK's richest peak are starting to go down, that it's no longer as dire as it looked earlier on in the year. But that's not to say that the UK is out of the woods. I mean, we're seeing countries around the world that look like they were okay starting to gain some spikes. So I don't think the UK's government is, you know, very confident here that they're done. But this is at least a way to mitigate some of the economic effects while hopefully trying to keep the amount of cases low. But that is a risk still. There's no question.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about one of the countries that had gotten high marks for how it handled the virus, and that's Germany. What happened when Germany began reopening?
Well, according to the Robert Koch Institute, which is the fancy name for their Center of Disease Control, effectively, the infectious rate, the R rate, let's say, has gone above one based on their own analysis. However, a major caveat here is that if you look at the statistical model, the number could also dip below one in the, you know, statistical variation. But either way, you do have federal officials in Germany saying there is a chance that a singular person with the coronavirus could infect more than one person. That is the warning that they're worried about now, and that is a potential tick upward. So Germany, by no means out of the woods, in fact, could be seeing an uptick in cases down the line, but it might be a bit too early to raise the alarm bells there for the moment.
And are they completely reopened? What does it look like there?
It's looking somewhat similar. I mean, Germany did not do a massive mandatory, you know, everyone stay at home for every second of the day kind of situation. They were very good with testing, tracing, isolation. But now you see Germans back more into the streets, still following a lot of the guidelines. And so not much necessarily has changed. Germany's big change really is that a lot of coronavirus cases, it has a lot of coronavirus cases, but its death rate is pretty low, although that's ticking upward. So for the moment, Germany doing its best to kind of play in the middle road.
South Korea also was lauded for keeping its cases and death rate low, but there was a big outbreak at a nightclub. What happened there?
Yeah, the weekend of May 1st, a 29-year-old man attended five nightclubs and that's allowed. South Korea, despite imposing pretty strict social distancing measures, did not, you know, private businesses did not have to close. And so restaurants were still open, some clubs as well, although many voluntarily closed. And it turns out that this man tested positive for the coronavirus on May 6th, ironically the day that South Korea had loosened some of these social distancing restrictions. And so now it appears that the South Korean government has tracked at least 80 cases to this man's late night. And there could be many more cases down the line. And South Korea, which had not reported any local cases as recently as about a week or two ago, now is on the upswing in terms of cases again. So we've seen the mayor of Seoul, the capital, close down restaurants, close down clubs indefinitely for the moment. And you've seen the president of South Korea effectively warn of a second wave. So what looked like a really good start and perhaps the model that all the world should show, in South Korea, what we're seeing now is that even one person's actions could undo a lot of good government work. And that is really indicative of the kinds of complications any country could see as they consider the risks of opening up.
Oh, absolutely. One person infecting 80 people who then could go on to infect many more others. That's quite sobering.
Yes. And it's not to say that, of course, there are genuine trade-offs that government should consider between public health and economics. No one is denying that. But if anyone says that opening up is going to be a very clear success because of economic issues, well, that's just obviously not the case. The risks here are legion. And in fact, a lot of this is luck, too. You know, had South Korea continued the way it was going and this gentleman not gone out, then maybe we wouldn't be seeing this kind of uptick and South Korea wouldn't be getting the negative press that it is at the moment. So we may be seeing South Korea take further, more aggressive lockdown measures. In fact, one proposal by the mayor of Seoul is to effectively have telecommunications companies track the people who were around the nightclub that night in order to get them tested. And that, in a lot of countries, no less the United States, many could consider that a big privacy violation. But these are the kinds of policy choices that opening up a country are starting to lead leaders to consider.
Mm. Okay, so let's go to what was believed to be the epicenter of this whole crisis, and that's Wuhan, China. What's happening there?
Well, we're seeing Wuhan start to open up a little bit. I mean, this is part of China's entire effort to try to get back to normal. That said, you are seeing that Wuhan has now seen its first new coronavirus cases since that lockdown was lifted. And so, again, what looked like maybe China kind of getting over that hump, or Wuhan specifically getting over that hump, you know, the second people start to go outside, you start seeing some improvement economically, but then some people get sick, and now you start having people worry about perhaps a new outbreak in what was the global epicenter. And so, yet again, this is somewhat the theme. I think any country that opens up, it's showing that you might see an uptick in cases, you might see worries about a second wave and perhaps more people getting sick. The question is, how much can governments handle that? How much will the public deal with that kind of situation? And whether governments can effectively find a way to keep a lid on that second wave, which almost at this point seems inevitable.
So any countries that we've not paid attention to who are doing a really good job?
I think there are a bunch of unheralded cases out there. I think Vietnam is one. I mean, despite being a lower income country that's densely populated and sharing a large land border with China, I mean, it's effectively kept its cases extremely, extremely low. And part of that is just they've gone above and beyond in testing and tracing and isolation. Again, countries like Slovenia as well, and even Greece, believe it or not, which is a country many consider to be effectively a basket case in Europe, is starting to consider bringing tourists back in the summer, which many public health officials think that's too soon. But you're starting to see some countries that have had major success start to consider life beyond these lockdowns. And as we're seeing already with the examples we've talked about, that should be taken with a grain of salt. It can be done. It can be done slowly, but it really has to be managed. And in fact, what public health officials are telling me and others is that perhaps, there isn't just a closing and a reopening. There's a reopening and a closing and an opening and a closing again and again until you either get to the vaccine or some kind of, threshold of infections, and you realize that this is going to be a much longer term effort than turning a switch on and turning a switch off.
Alex Ward, he covers international security and defense issues for Vox. Thanks, Alex.
Thank you.
Coming up, two big cases at the Supreme Court this week, one involving President Trump's financial records, the other, the Electoral College. Legal. Jessica Levinson is here to explain next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The Supreme Court hears a couple of big cases this week. Tomorrow, whether President Trump can block the release of his financial records. And on Wednesday, whether Electoral College voters have to vote for the presidential candidate who wins their state, or if they can vote for whomever they want, whomever they personally want. And as they were last week, the arguments will be heard over conference call, so anyone can listen in, including Jessica Levinson. She's a law professor at Loyola Law School and a regular Legal. Hi.
Hi.
All right, let's begin with the case involving President Trump, his financial records, and whether or not he should be forced to release them, or at least his banks and accountants should be forced to release them. These are three consolidated cases, two of which involve congressional committees seeking this information. What does Congress want?
Exactly. Well, in one case, the congressional committee is saying, we need these financial records because we're looking into whether or not government ethics laws are sufficient. In the other case, the congressional committee is saying, we're looking into foreign influence of U.S. elections, and we need to follow the money to complete that investigation. So in both cases, Congress is saying, we have either a legitimate legislative purpose and or a legitimate oversight purpose. President, on the other hand, is saying, absolutely not. You're on a fishing expedition. And what you really want is just to try and punish me for alleged bad behavior. And there's a mechanism for doing that. That's called the impeachment process. And you already tried that, Congress.
And what is he saying to the third case? And this one is involving Manhattan DA Cyrus Vance.
Yeah, the third case deals with Cyrus Vance, who is essentially the state grand jury subpoenaed the president's accountant, again, for financial records. And what the president is saying is, I'm constitutionally immune from not just prosecution, but also from investigation. The state of New York is saying, you might have constitutional immunity for indictment or prosecution, but that doesn't extend to what we're doing, which is just investigating. We need this information now before the evidence goes stale. We need this information now before you might have a statute of limitations run against other potential defendants. And so there's no reason that you can't comply. It's not going to interfere with your duties as president. And in fact, you didn't even argue that this information was either privileged or that it would interfere with your ability to discharge your job.
Well, what is the bigger case in New York? What are they actually looking into?
Yeah, so they're looking into potential violations of state law dealing with financial transactions of President Trump and the Trump Organization, some of their business dealings. As far as I understand, they haven't been particularly specific. But obviously, the bigger question for the Supreme Court is whether or not they can continue this investigation at all. Because without those financial records, and President Trump likely knows this, the investigation really stalls out.
Hmm. Well, the Justice Department has weighed in on this on the side of the president. And the bigger issue, I suppose, is this ongoing battle over how much power the president should have versus how much oversight he should be subjected to.
That's exactly right. Throughout the Trump administration, we've seen this expansion of executive authority in a number of different situations. Think about the travel ban, think about the emergency declaration of a national emergency. And what we're seeing here is this tension between the two branches, mostly the congressional branch when they're for instance, exercising their oversight authority, and the president when he's either saying, you don't have the power to do that, or I'm asserting executive privilege, which he's not asserting in these two cases. So there's been this battle for years now between the two branches. And in fact, the Supreme Court may actually say, take that fight outside Congress and the president, because they themselves asked for briefing on a question as to whether or not the case is a so-called political question, meaning judges have no role in making the decision. So it'll be really interesting to see how oral arguments go and how many questions there are in this political question doctrine.
Okay, so that's one case that they're looking at. Another case has to do with the Electoral College and presidential electors. These are the 538 people whose votes ultimately elect the president and the vice president in the Electoral College. And as far as I thought, they were supposed to just basically rubber stamp the popular vote in their states. But that didn't happen in the last presidential election in these two cases. Can you give us a summary of them?
Yeah, exactly. So there are two different cases where essentially both electors wanted to vote for somebody other than Hillary Clinton. And in both cases, there were state laws where the electors had basically either taken an oath or were subject to a penalty if they didn't vote according to how the state popular vote went, according to how they had pledged to vote. And the two different cases bring up two similar but different questions. In one case, the question is, do you as an elector actually have a First Amendment, a freedom of speech right to cast your electoral vote for the candidate who you want? Not the candidate who the voters wanted, but the candidate who you want. The second case, it's a similar question as to whether or not under the Constitution that created the Electoral College, do electors have discretion to vote for whoever they want, or can states implement these laws where they force electors under either penalty of breaking an oath or penalty of paying a fine to say, you have to vote according to how the state popular vote went? We don't have answers to those questions because mostly electors are party loyalists and they're picked because we're not worried about whether or not they'll follow the rules. We think that they will, and generally speaking, they do. Now, in a close election, like we might have in a upside-down world in 2020, this case could have very real-world implications in November and December.
Well, yeah, and then the election, when you look at the election, the 2000 election, George W. Bush versus Al Gore, he won by one vote, one electoral vote, right?
Exactly. So, you know, it is not outside of the realm of possibility that we could see a situation where we have a very close split in the Electoral College and where just a few electors in a few key states could make the difference. So a lot of people are going to be looking at this case. There is, again, another little escape hatch for the court, at least on one of the cases, where they might say that the elector in Colorado, in one of the cases, doesn't have standing because he's a state official, so he might not be able to bring this case. So look for the Supreme Court to try and find ways to narrow these cases, to basically make the smallest decisions they possibly can going into an election year.
So they might not say, okay, this really shines a light on how useless the Electoral College is, let's get rid of it. They're not going to do that.
No, I mean, you could certainly see one of the justices decide to pontificate in a concurrence or a dissent, or less likely in a majority opinion. But I don't think they're going to address as a policy matter, should we have the Electoral College or not? That's outside the realm of the Supreme Court.
All right. Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School and our regular Legal, and co-host of our brand new Legal Files podcast, which you can get for free wherever you get your podcasts. It's just you, Jessica, and me, Madeline, chit-chatting about the law and a couple personal issues. It's a fun time. So if you like this kind of talk, check it out. The Legal Files. Thank you, Jessica.
Thank you, Madeline.
Coming up, what it's like to get on a plane these days.
He actually blocked my seat with his leg. And there was this whole standoff that ensued between the flight attendant and the passenger.
Anxious, angry passengers. And what's the future of airline travel? Will your temperature be checked before you board? Will the middle seats still exist? That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, if you're like me and many others, your travel plans have been postponed for the foreseeable future. No summer vacation abroad, no quick trip back home to see your family. Airline operators say they're averaging only about a couple dozen people on each domestic flight. And those passengers are getting a glimpse of what airline travel could be like for quite some time. And it's not pretty. McKay Coppins is a staff writer at The Atlantic, where he wrote about a recent air travel experience. The headline reads, "I just flew. It was worse than I thought it would be." Hi, McKay.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So when did you fly and where did you go?
It was the end of April, and it was a two-leg trip for reporting purposes. I'm not going to say the final destination for now, because you'll find out later when I write my piece. But it was through O'Hare. So it was out of D.C. through O'Hare. And, you know, the first flight was pretty empty, kind of as I expected. The airplane, the airport was empty. The plane itself only had a few passengers. The pilot actually warned us before we took off that because it was such a light load, it would be a very dramatic escalation when we ascended into the air. And, you know, it definitely was. It was like a roller coaster. But the second flight was a lot more full, and that's what kind of prompted me to write the story that I did.
And that's when you had your experience, shall we say, that was worse than you thought it might be. Well, let's get into that. So first of all, can you just describe what security is like these days? Because it used to be these long snaking lines, but now I guess they have to space everyone apart. Is it a lot longer or is it because there aren't that many people?
Yeah, that part of it is actually great. When I arrived at Reagan National Airport in D.C., there was literally no one at the security checkpoint. I was the only one in line. So I walked straight to the front. Wow. There are a bunch of TSA agents just kind of hanging out, talking. They let me right through. It's funny, though, right behind me, a family of like three or four came up. And they were the TSA agents were like shocked. They're like, "Wow, we haven't seen this many people in forever." So getting through TSA is pretty easy these days.
Okay, so let's talk about the second flight, which was the flight from hell. It seemed like from reading your piece. So it's a two seats per row, right, on this flight.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And you get to your seat and.
Well, there's. So I got to the seat. I mean, everyone, I think, was pretty shocked by how full it was. I think we all expected it to be pretty light. So everybody's already kind of agitated and nervous, and everyone's wearing masks, and everyone's trying to kind of grumble at each other to stay away, keep their distance. And I got to my seat, and there was a guy sitting in the aisle seat. I had the aisle seat. He was sitting in the window seat. And I went to sit down and he stopped me and kind of gruffly told me, you know, sit somewhere else. We need social distance. And so I am not a very confrontational flyer. So I decided to just comply. And I sat in the row behind him. But right then a flight attendant showed up and said, "Actually, we're still boarding. We need everyone to sit in their assigned seats." So I got up to go take my seat. And the flight attendant came and told me to sit down, and he would not let me sit down, this other, my would-be seatmate. He actually blocked my seat with his leg and kind of angrily protested that we shouldn't be seated next to each other because, you know, it's dangerous and there's plenty of other space for him to sit. And there really wasn't. There just weren't that many empty seats on this flight. And there was this whole standoff that ensued between the flight attendant and the passenger. And it finally, he relented, but it was kind of a little spectacle. And finally, I sat down and he's, you know, muttering profanities under his breath. And the payoff, though, was that I tried to be very calm and I didn't kind of intervene. I was just letting them hash it out. Finally, I sat down and a couple minutes later, a flight attendant came back and kind of glared at the other guy and then told me I was being moved up to first class. So, I guess there was a little bit of a, you know, reward for not being too much of a jerk. But I mean, I understood why he was nervous. It was, you know, it was pretty unnerving being on a plane with that many other people at this moment. I should say, I mean, I was traveling for reporting purposes and I couldn't really reschedule it, but I would not be doing, you know, going forward, I don't plan to get on another plane again for a while.
Well, do you know why that plane was so full?
I don't. I did hear some of the flight attendants, once I got up to first class, I heard some of the flight attendants talking about it, and they said it was one of the more full flights they'd seen since they kind of started social distancing. And I think that, I don't know for sure, but it looked like they had consolidated flights because my original flights got changed to another time that day. So it seems like they were trying to consolidate flights as much as possible. I mean, as you noted at the top, the airline industry is not doing well, right?
No.
I mean, they already operate on relatively thin margins. And so, you know, with this much drop off in passenger demand, it's obviously been pretty difficult. But I mean, I think it underscores for me how even once kind of everybody starts to return to quote unquote normal, it's not going to be quite the experience that we remember from pre-pandemic times.
Right. Well, what about the service and what about the flight attendants? Were they all wearing masks? And they're really, when you think about it, they're flying a lot and taking on some personal risk. How are they dealing
Definitely.
With it?
Yeah, so every flight attendant I saw was wearing a mask. Most of the passengers were wearing masks, too. And my understanding is that airlines are going to start requiring masks in the coming days. They had also suspended kind of beverage and snack service for the main cabin. So we didn't see the flight attendants very much once the plane took off. And my general feeling, even at the airport, you know, most of the shops and restaurants were closed at both O'Hare and Reagan National. But the ones that were open, you know, everyone was wearing masks. People were keeping far apart from each other. But yeah, you obviously the people who are actually working these jobs to keep planes moving are taking on an enormous amount of personal risk. And I would like to pause here just to commend them because everyone I worked with, I encountered was very patient, very professional, doing their best. It was really the other flyers, the other travelers who were kind of getting agitated and losing their cool.
Right. And so even under the best of circumstances, flying is a chore and not pleasant. So I guess this just amplifies that. And like you said, unless you have to, you're not going to get on a plane anytime soon.
I definitely don't plan to. And I mean, I also think, you know, so much of even regular flying, like the only way that that experience works, it's like a lot of things, you know, going to concerts and baseball games, going out to bars or restaurants. It's all predicated on kind of this mutual understanding that we'll all put up with each other, right? Like we're all strangers in this experience together. It's not always pleasant. We're trying to do our best. But when you add on top of that, this, you know, threat of deadly disease, this virus, that kind of social contract is strained. And my experience was that people were very suspicious of each other, very wary of each other. Everybody was kind of agitated and their nerves were fraying. And that experience, I think, for at least the, you know, short term is going to be pretty common. So I think if you can avoid it, I would not be getting on a plane sometime this summer.
Okay. Well, thanks for the warning. I wasn't planning on it anyway, but thank you so much. McKay Coppins from The Atlantic taking a flight so we don't have to. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, everyone wearing masks, no beverage or meal service, agitated passengers. Is McKay's experience going to be our experience when we start flying again en masse? Well, my next guest says the impact of COVID-19 will be even more far-reaching than 9/11 was on the airline industry. Shashank Nigam is the CEO of the airline consulting group Simply Flying, and he joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Well, first, before we get into your predictions, you told me before we started taping that you also flew recently but had a different experience. Can you briefly tell us what that was like?
Yes, indeed. I was on a repatriation flight from India, where we were stuck, back to Canada. And we traveled across 4 international airports on 3 different flights and 2 big airlines with 2 toddlers. Now, the toddler part was the hard part, the vigilance required to sanitize everything from trolley handles to in-flight armrests and screens was really tiring. Having said that, my experience was quite different in terms of the people. I felt that the people were much kinder and nicer than they typically are in a stressful situation like going through the security at the airport. They were much nicer inside the plane. The flight attendants weren't dealing with a fully crowded plane. And when they were, we received food that was individually wrapped in plastic rather than not receiving food. And overall, I felt the crew as well as other passengers were much more gracious and kinder than they normally are.
Mm. Well, let's hope your experience becomes the more accepted experience than McKay's experience in terms of the level of kindness. However, what you paint is a picture of a very different way of traveling. Let's start with the sanitation part of it. What do you think is going to happen when it comes to trying to make airline travel safe from a sanitary perspective?
Absolutely. I think just like how passengers wanted to board a flight without weapons after 9/11, they want to board a flight without viruses. And airlines, airports need to do whatever they can to assure passengers that it's safe to fly again. And by that, they need to highlight what they're doing in terms of sanitation. So when you enter an airport, for example, you might have to go through a disinfection tunnel where you're just sprayed on with invisible particles and it makes sure that everyone inside the airport is disinfected. This is already in place like in airports like Hong Kong International Airport and Abu Dhabi International Airport in the UAE. When you go drop your bag will be sanitagged, where your bag will go through UV ray disinfection or thermal fogging. That ensures that every single bag in the baggage system is clean and disinfected before it goes through. So that's just going to be the beginning.
Right. And so what about preventing people who might have the virus from boarding? Would there be any way to do that? Would there be temperature checks, for example?
Absolutely. In fact, my temperature was checked multiple times during my journey as well. I believe there will be temperature checks. Further on, there might be immunity passports or fit to fly cards that you might have once there's a vaccine for this. But meanwhile, you've seen airports like Vienna Airport and Dubai International Airport administering COVID tests and antibody tests, which is, you know, a small blood test. In Dubai's case, you take 10 minutes and you have a report whether you can board or not. In Vienna's case, when you land in Vienna, you can take the COVID-19 test, wait for 2 hours, and then avoid a 2-week quarantine.
And so that's already in practice right now. They're already doing that.
It's being done. In fact, we have about 70 predictions in our report, and about 83% of them are already in practice in one airport or another around the world.
What about security? McKay said, well, it wasn't a big deal because there are so few people flying. But once people get back to flying regularly, what is security going to look like?
Yeah, I think the security theater is going to change into a health theater. Because just think about the bins. All of us touch the bins, and if there's some germs on the bins, you know, we don't want them passing around. So simple things like a UV disinfection unit installed next to the X-ray machine will ensure that all the bins going through the X-ray machine and your carry-on items will be disinfected when they come out at the other end. You will have everything from hand sanitizer, and you will not be passing stuff around. It will be all a touchless operation where you can just scan your boarding pass yourself and you can carry on through the security corridor.
I mean, I'm just imagining the lines. How are people going to line up 6 feet apart?
Yeah, I think social distancing being enforced at the airport is not going to be the easiest thing. So it might mean multiple security counters as opposed to just one or two big points where people tend to choke. It might mean airports displaying, hey, out of the 3 security gates here, which has the least amount of traffic and hence the most potential for social distancing. So you might see next to the counters at the entrance with the flight departure screens, you might see which are the security counters with the least waiting time or the maximum social distancing space available.
Still, I can imagine this is going to add a lot more time to the whole process.
So in the immediate aftermath, when people start flying again, and also on peaks just before Thanksgiving. Hey, we are used to going to the airport maybe 2 hours earlier, and the weekend before Thanksgiving, maybe 3 hours earlier. Similarly, right after people start flying, maybe you need to go to the airport 4 hours earlier. But we don't foresee that continuing to be a practice because bag disinfection, no additional time. Security, yes, for the queuing and lining up, more time, but then disinfection, no additional time. So hopefully airlines and airports can scale this in a manner that most of the measures that stay on will not result in people coming to the airport much earlier or costing a lot more for the trip, you know, like buying masks and gloves and things like that.
But what about when you're on the plane itself? Are planes going to have to be reconfigured? Those seats are awfully close together. Are they going to have to take seats out and therefore charge more per seat when they actually get paying customers on board?
Yeah. So the leaving middle seat empty on a plane, to me, is a purely optic solution. There is no scientific proof or economic justification for doing this long term. I don't know any airline in the world that makes money at 62% load factors, which is what will happen if you take out the middle seat or you block the middle seat in the long term. This may be something airlines are doing in the beginning while not many people are flying to assure customers that, hey, we will do our best. But once people are flying again, guess what? Once you're on board the plane, it's really the last place where you might be spreading the virus if you've gone through multiple security checkpoints and immigration and things like that even before that at the airport or even at the bus stand, right? So once you're in the middle seat, you are in the middle seat, and hopefully the flying experience will be a bit more pleasant, if I may say that, because you will have everything from a health and safety and sanitization video to watch, not just a safety video. And you might even, for long-haul flights, have a in-flight janitor who's assuring passengers that, hey, you know what? There's a cleaning log and the lavatories and the high-touch areas are being cleaned regularly.
All right. I, for one, would welcome the removal of the middle seat, but I can understand why that's not feasible economically. Shashank Nigam, he's CEO of the airline consulting group Simply Flying. Thank you for joining.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Coming up, Chicano Batman has a new album out. Two members of the LA band are here next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Lucid dream, that's what it seems. I'm not really sure if it's real, but I just got to say I found my way. The forest got some magical feel, yeah. You got to come into my life. Well, if you listen to KCRW a lot, you've heard a lot of the LA band Chicano Batman. Their brand new album has been in the works for a couple of years now. It's called Invisible People, and it's brimming over with their signature psychedelic tropicalia grooves. Two members of the group join me now to talk about the record and how the band is faring in quarantine. Carlos Arevalo plays guitar in the band, and Bardo Martinez is the lead singer. Welcome back to Press Play.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Great to have you. Let's talk about this album, Invisible People. It came out a couple of days ago. That song we just heard, Color My Life, was the first single off the record. What is that song about?
Color My Life is just kind of like a personal exploration, really. You know, it's, I don't know, it's, you know, for me as a songwriter, you're as a person living in society, you can't ignore what's going on around you, right? But it's like, yo, you really got to retreat and just kind of be yourself and let your dream state take over. So I kind of like to put it that way. And also just telling people, yo, like, this is what we're feeling. This is just a vibe for you to dance, to groove, to have fun with, you know, just trying to have fun with the lyrics and really just have stuff that, you know, just create music that people could sing along to.
Yeah. So we talked a little bit last time about how you like to have music that is groovy and fun and danceable, but also have lyrics that are pretty political and intense. And that's done on purpose, right?
Yeah, I like juxtaposition. I love the way some of my favorite artists I love, like, how could I put it? Like abstract art, you know, it's all about contradiction. And I think mm-hmm. we live in a very contradictory time. And it just, you can't help it but to throw it in the music.
What is contradictory to you about this time?
Just capitalism as a whole, right? Just the way things are, you know, just the way we consume goods, the way we, you know, it's really not the way everything else in nature functions.
I want to hear a little bit from the title track. Here is Invisible People off Invisible People. Spinning the world around you, you best believe we're taking over. And this is called Invisible People. And so who are you talking about there?
As a person, I could think about what that means to me on so many different levels. As a Latino, I could think about that as a human being. I could think mm-hmm. about it as one member of this band within this music industry trying to make it. You know, we have this dope record. We got amazing music. And it's just like just throwing the mic down, like we're spinning the world around you, you know, even though we're right here in our houses. Eventually, we're going to get on that stage and we're going to lay it down. You know, we're going to lay it down and we're going to have fun. And, you know, that's what we're here to do. But there's layers to it. But yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, as you're saying, as a Latino, a lot of Latinos on the front lines during this pandemic, and we've talked a lot about that, the people who were, quote unquote, invisible, now very visible, and everybody relying on them more than ever. Is that also part of it? I know you wrote this song before this happened, but...
Sure. I mean, you know, it's like invisible people. I mean, have you read that book, Invisible Man?
Yeah. Ralph Ellison.
Ralph Ellison, yeah. So it's just going along with that. I mean, I think it really doesn't matter, you know, what group of, you know, what ethnic group you come from, as it were, or, you know, what classification you fit in. And I think really that's the point of the song. The point of the song is like this concept of race. You know, you could take it back to the advent of scientific racism, right? Where it's like all these really just trying to put that into question, like putting that at, like into the forefront, like, you know, we're daily calling ourselves this or that. I do it all the time. I just did it right now. I call myself Latino, but the truth is like, you know, I did my DNA test. Carlos has done his DNA test. You know, I'm like a fifth African, like a third, you know, like 20-30% European, almost 40% native to the Americas. So it's complex. Like our genetics are very complex, and our genetics actually tell this true story of humanity and you know, the migration of one group to one place or another, because there's no such thing as immigration. That's just a political construct. Now, there's people moving around. People been moving all around for thousands of years. We operate within these kind of social constructs daily, and we don't really delve into a really complex reality.
Yeah. So normally, in normal times, you would come out with an album and then go on tour to support it and perform it. And you're not doing that right now. So what are you doing right now, Carlos?
Yeah, right now we're promoting the record, which means a lot of press. And because we are so accessible, more than we normally would be at this point of a tour, we're doing a lot of work. We're doing like 9-to-5 interviews, thankfully. And yeah, that's one aspect. We're still being creative. We're working on music right now as we speak and bouncing around ideas, trying this new reality, which is very different for us. The way Chicano Batman has traditionally functioned as a band, and we take pride in it, is we're a band. We get together and see our faces and collaborate and have catalysts that, you know, someone sparks an idea and then somebody reacts in real time. And we get real face-to-face feedback. Hey, I'm not feeling that bass line, or hey, that guitar part's great. Let's go that direction. We can't do that now. And that's the way a lot of modern musicians work nowadays. Even bands, they don't work in an environment like that. It's usually like sending files over the internet from across the country at times, you know, is sometimes the case. And so this is kind of new for us, sending, here's my vocals and my guitar, try some drums to this, you know, let's see the bass line. And it's, you know, we're trying to figure out the workflow, and it's interesting. And I think if at the bottom of it, it's going to help us just flex another muscle of our musicianship and production.
So you're not doing it on Zoom together. You're doing it privately, and then you send each other the files?
Yeah, I mean, we have a long text chain going, and we did have a Zoom meeting very briefly and kind of talked about some direction for some of the material that we're working on. But, yeah, we're just trying to figure out that new workflow. And, you know, there's a lot of trial and error, and it means that we need to probably communicate a little more specifically and not leave some things up to interpretation. But it's been positive, and it's very interesting, and I never thought we'd work like this, but here we are.
So let's play a little bit more from the album. This song is called "I Know It," and it seems like it's more of a love song. Am I right in that interpretation?
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Okay, good. Here's "I Know It." I missed you all this time. I was so busy rewinding you into my mind. Now I found myself all alone. We used to chat before. Now I need to warn. Then I start to feel that there is some cold. It will help me go. Fate will prevail. And we will be together. So hopeful we'll meet again. It feels like that's far away, meeting again in person, but maybe not.
Maybe not. There's a bunch of people at the beach having a good time right now, probably.
Oh, God. Oh, my God. That just makes my gives me palpitations thinking about that.
Blood pressure rising.
Oh, my gosh. It just seems like, I don't know, it seems like that song is like a postcard from another more carefree era. Do you feel that way listening to it?
Honestly, Madeline, it was just like, I think a big part of this record was just making songs that are just going to be catchy and people are going to sing, you know, just what this record, we just spent a lot of time trying to create hooks and, you know, just not have everything be so heavy all the time in terms of like we talked about and explored some heavy topics from the get, just catchy songs, you know, just regular songs that doesn't even matter who the band is. Just like, yo, check out this track. You know, like, right. this is a dope track.
Well, it's nice to have a mix, because if it was just all light and fluffy, there wouldn't be anything to sink your teeth into. And if it was all dark, it would be a little, it would be very heavy.
Yeah, totally.
Right.
Yeah, I feel like it's definitely a mix of all that on this record. There's a lot of all kinds of different emotions, I guess.
So are you missing the summer festival season? Are you going to miss performing live at these festivals?
This is Carlos. I missed it. I look forward to going on tour behind a new record. You know, it's for me, it's kind of like a little reward for the hard work. You know, we've been home for on and off for the past 2 years, with the majority of the focus being on making this new album and little tour dates, fly dates here and there. But we haven't really had our own headlining tour since 2017. A lot of the tour dates we've been doing have been opening for bands like Vampire Weekend or Portugal the Man, and that's a completely different headspace to be in as a performer. You're trying to win over an audience that probably 50% of them don't want to see you because you're just in the way of them seeing the band they came to see. And then there's the other 50%, which are like, all right, you know, entertain me and let's see if I'll buy your record afterwards. But I miss it, and I was looking forward to, here we are. We're back with a new record that we're very proud of. And we're going to give you the best show we've ever come up with as a band. And unfortunately, that's been placed on hold, as it has been with every other professional musician right now.
And thank you, KCRW, for the love, because we definitely felt that all along the way.
That's Bardo Martinez and Carlos Arevalo, one half of the LA-based band Chicano Batman. Their new album is called Invisible People. It's out now. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you, Madeline. Take care.
Thank you, safe. I just want to love you.
And that's it for us here at Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.